KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Fairfax, California.
Glen Park.
Fillmore.
I'm from San Jose.
I'm from the Intermission.
UCCC World.
West Oakland.
East Oakland.
Coming up, how the firestorm up north will affect the affordable housing crisis.
Santa Rosa lost about 5% of its total housing stock from the Tubbs Fire. And that's about five times the number of homes that the city built all last year.
Then how San Francisco's hot housing market is keeping homeless people out of available units.
Hotels are routinely 10 to 15% empty, but that's not crazy. However, if you talk about them in terms of housing, then that's a glaring number.
And the story of the man who made Golden Gate Park.
John McLaren was actually credited with planting over 2 million trees, which is pretty remarkable in and of itself.
The places we call home today on Cross Currents. CAL FIRE has named the blazes that devastated Sonoma and Napa counties earlier this month the October Fire Siege. FEMA is saying this is the worst fire disaster in California history. As of today, evacuation orders have been lifted for all but a few fire zones, but thousands of people are displaced with no home to return to. KALW's housing reporter Liza Veal is here with me to talk through the consequences for North Bay homeowners and renters, real estate, and people at risk of homelessness. Hey, Liza.
Hi, Hana.
So what's the status of the fires today?
There are still firefighters out there working on Tubbs Fire and the Nuns Fire and other big fires in Napa and Sonoma, but most of them are projected to be fully contained by the end of the week.
Okay.
At this point, there's just a few hundred people still staying in the shelters. There were thousands, but yeah, they're staying in schools, they're staying in churches, state fairgrounds. They even opened up some casinos.
Hmm. So those places are just set up like regular shelters?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they provide little mats for sleeping. They serve meals. Some have medical and mental health services, people to help with insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard that the atmosphere in these shelters is really emotionally heavy and not necessarily in a totally bad way. I talked to one person who's staying at the Sonoma County Fairgrounds, and her friend had offered to put her up in Marin, but she actually wanted to stay in the shelter. She said she felt like the shelter was where she was supposed to be. She didn't want to be isolated from the other people who shared this experience with her.
Oh. So do most people know at this point if their homes are gone or not?
Most people know, but not every fire site has been opened up for residents to return back to and find out.
Mm-hmm.
More than 8,000 structures have been burned. Santa Rosa lost about 5% of its total housing stock from the Tubbs Fire. And that's about five times the number of homes that the city built all last year.
Right. 5% can really affect the whole city's real estate.
Yeah, and Santa Rosa was already really short on housing. The average rent increased at least 10% since last October.
Wow.
That's the steepest increase of any Bay Area city.
Mm-hmm.
So now, with a bunch of people losing their homes, looking to rent a place with almost no vacancies around, that just puts a lot of upward pressure on the price of rent.
Okay, mm-hmm. So do we know, was it rental housing that was lost in the fire?
I talked to officials in Sonoma County this morning, and they haven't got counts down exactly for what kinds of buildings burned down.
Okay.
We know that two trailer parks were hit, but the neighborhoods with the most damage were generally middle and upper middle class neighborhoods with mostly single family homes,
mm-hmm.
which means just that the likelihood that people will be insured is a little better than if the majority of the damage was to poorer or more renter heavy neighborhoods.
Right.
But it still means that thousands of people are looking for housing right now.
Yeah.
And I also want to add that Coffee Park, one of the most thoroughly destroyed neighborhoods, it's not near wilderness or agriculture. It's separated from parkland by the 101. And I was talking to my friend whose childhood home in Coffee Park burned down.
Mm.
And he said, it's as if a neighborhood in the flats of Oakland burned down. You know, relatively modern building materials. It just kind of boggles the mind.
Mm. So is there anything that city officials in Santa Rosa can do to kind of ease the pressure on rents or make it easier for people to find an affordable place?
Well, there's a law in California that prohibits price gouging after a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
So rents can't go up more than 10%. But this past June, voters in Santa Rosa just very narrowly voted down this measure that would have implemented rent and eviction controls. So if there were rent control right now, they could keep prices from going up at all.
Mm.
And so Santa Rosa Supervisor Julie Combs, she said that putting rent control on the 2018 ballot is now urgent.
But in the meantime, what will happen to people who have lost their homes?
A lot of people's insurance will pay for a hotel for a certain amount of time. And everyone else will probably lean on their network, staying with parents and kids and friends until they can find a new place to buy or rent.
Right.
I recently reported on the aftermath of the Lake County fires back in 2015. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people had just moved away from the area, not wanting to try to rebuild in a neighborhood that was kind of a ghost of its former self.
Yeah.
Or not wanting to go through the hassle. I mean, people in Lake County are still waiting for contractors to become available and for prices that surged after the Valley fire to come down. So in Sonoma and Napa, it's going to be a big, long, expensive rebuild for the insurance companies, but also for the underinsured and the uninsured and for the cities and counties and for the businesses that were hit. I mean, like FEMA said, it's the biggest fire disaster in the state's history.
If you've got a housing story you'd like to see reported, email Liza at housing@klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. The latest edition of the San Francisco Public Press includes a story about one possible solution to homelessness, a solution that lies with hotels, SROs to be exact, single room occupancy hotels. They're hotels that rent out rooms by the week or month to low-income San Francisco residents, and they're often thought of as a first step out of homelessness. Longtime San Francisco journalist Joe Eskenazi wrote the cover story, No Vacancy for the Homeless, examining how hundreds of rooms in these hotels remain vacant while people live on the streets. Eskenazi explores the reasons why these rooms are not occupied, and especially when so many people need them. He joins me in studio.
The number of empty rooms is somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 to 20% of all the privately owned stock in the city. And if you're talking about these in context of hotels, that's not a lot. Hotels are routinely 10 to 15% empty in this city. Often we get above 90%, but that's not crazy. However, if you talk about them in terms of housing, which they are by de facto, we keep leaning on these SROs to be our last line of defense of quote-unquote affordable housing, then that's a glaring number. The vacancy rate in San Francisco is infinitesimal. So to have 15, 20% is a lot. And I'm being a bit loose there. We just don't know. The number I have is, it's right on the cover of the magazine here, is 1,827. But there are also 60 hotels that didn't respond to the Department of Building Inspection's queries. So we don't know how many more rooms there are than that.
Okay. So let's get into the why.
There are a number of reasons why, and each individual SRO has its own stories. And anyone who's ever been into an SRO knows that, just broadly speaking, every SRO has its own stories, as do the people who live there. Some of the reasons are innocuous. The rooms need to be repaired. The rooms are not up to code, et cetera, things that you expect in normal housekeeping. Some of the games that are being played, though, however, are rooms can be kept empty to drive up the value of the building. Rent-controlled tenants who know their way around the laws of the land and will complain to the manager or the supervisor of the district in the city if things are not going right, can be a pain in the ass, you know, if you're a bottom-line-oriented landlord. Mm-hmm. And you'd rather have the room empty when advertising it to a potential buyer, so that way the value of the building goes up, and the next person to rent that room will be paying market rate instead of $400 a month, as they might have done, 10, 20, 30 years ago.
Right.
So there's always that case, and that's not exclusive to single room occupancy hotels. There, I'm certain that is happening in many apartment buildings across the city.
Yeah, just in the rental market. Mm-hmm. So what is being done about this?
Well, we have to take a step back and say that the city has done a good job of housing people. There are well over 4,000 people who have been housed in what's known as the master leasing program, in which the city more or less rents out whole hotels and contracts nonprofits to run them.
Mm-hmm.
However, as noted in the story, the economies of scale are such that small hotels don't work for the city. The staffing costs are more or less fixed. A 24-hour desk clerk is a 24-hour desk clerk, whether he or she is in a 20-room hotel or a 200-room hotel. Something that I talked about with Randy Shaw in particular of Tenderloin Housing Clinic brought it up is maybe you could open up what's known as a step-up hotel that doesn't need a desk clerk. It doesn't need all of the 24-hour amenities. It doesn't need, you know, as many social workers, et cetera. It's for people who are a bit more stable. Mm-hmm. However, you kind of run into a wall here because the city is prioritizing the needs of the hardest up. And, you know, that's completely understandable. However, it does so at the expense of those who aren't quite as hard up. And it's, you know, a homeless and hardscrabble version of the classic dilemma in San Francisco in which the upper class is doing fine, nobody needs to worry about them, and the lower class has folks looking out for them, the middle class is neglected. Mm-hmm. In this case, you have, you know, maybe I'm stretching things here, I'm not trying to be flip, but you have the middle class of homeless people are being neglected. The folks who are stable, who maybe do not have the degree of mental illness of others, are being neglected in both resources and, in this case, housing, to prioritize those who are really, truly hard up.
Let's continue talking about solutions then. You wrote kind of a supplement to the article called How to Fill All the Empty SRO Rooms, Six Ideas.
Yeah, one of them is focusing on smaller hotels to house those who are doing just a little bit better, you know, who have kind of gotten up off the ground floor and don't need quite as much monitoring. Mm-hmm. And that would open up housing for, you know, it would be trickle-up housing. You know, these people wouldn't need to be in the navigation center. They'd be up, they'd be doing other things, and that would open up spaces and people would be able to move up the ladder. I mean, the navigation centers are great, but, you know, and this is a semantic thing. You know, where are you navigating to? Housing? Well, where's the housing, et cetera? You know, if you're just saying we have a very forgiving and generously endowed homeless shelter, that isn't have quite the ring to it. Mm. But that is what it is if you don't have places for them to navigate to. So there's that. Something else that you could do is, you know, as we refer to here, a daily clearinghouse. Something that one of the SRO owners told me is there's nowhere I can call to just say, I've got rooms. Mm. You know, there's nowhere he can call to say, I've got 10 rooms.
And he can't call the city.
Well, there's no one that handles that. You know, mm-hmm. Tenderloin Housing Clinic does do some block rentals, but I'm not sure anyone else does. And Tenderloin Housing Clinic was unaware of anyone else doing that. That is done in other cities. And, you know, I'm certain that there are a million reasons why that wouldn't work, but no one got into specifics for me. There are other agencies in other parts of the countries that make a point of not clustering homeless people into the same places just for the point that they won't be stigmatized as, oh, that's where all the quote-unquote crazy homeless people live. Mm. The one that I use as an example in this story is Pathways to Housing in Philadelphia, where they make a point of having people, you know, all around the city. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, you know, Philadelphia is far more geographically sprawling than San Francisco, and their workers, take the equivalent of zip cars or public transit. And it is more inconvenient for your caseworkers, et cetera, when you have to travel around. But, you know, at some point you have to balance the needs of the people and the needs of the administrators.
So which of these solutions do you think may actually have a chance of happening?
I don't think any one thing is going to help. And the thing is that, you know, San Francisco cannot solve America's homeless problem. You know, none of this is going to be solved without it being a priority of the state and of the federal government. And, you know, the city is doing a lot. You know, I think that at some point, you know, we write a lot of critical articles. We need to take a step back. You know, people are working hard. People are very well-intentioned. And there are a lot of great stories. And there are statistical indicators that some things are working well. But you're not going to, quote unquote, solve the problem any one way. And when it comes down to it also, you're not going to solve homelessness without housing. Housing is very hard to do in San Francisco, and you do have to get into ugly and difficult situations of does it make sense to build housing in the most expensive place to build housing in the entire world? It may not. It may be better to build the housing elsewhere, and you get into very difficult ethical quandaries about who gets to live in San Francisco and who doesn't.
So where do you see this going then?
Oh, I don't know, Modesto, right? but you know, there's the price of inaction is very high. You know, I mean, you can't do nothing.
Joe Eskenazi wrote the cover story, No Vacancy for the Homeless, in the most recent edition of the San Francisco Public Press. Find the online version at klw.org. Click Cross Currents.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. 4 years ago this week, two close friends single-handedly cared for 16 stranded elderly residents at an assisted facility home in Castro Valley. The two men worked as a janitor and a cook. The rest of the employees left after the home abruptly shut down and they stopped getting paid. But Miguel Alvarez and Maurice Roland stayed on, spending 3 days tending to the needs of the abandoned patients until emergency workers came to their aid. The two reflected in a StoryCorps booth about what that formative experience was like.
I mean, we already had seen our coworkers stop coming to work.
And if we left, they wouldn't have nobody.
How could we just go home knowing these people, they're going to be alone? When everything happened, I was cooking, passing out meds, helping sweep and mop the floors.
I was just sweeping and cleaning up beds. Then after, I just started cleaning people up, washing them down, helping them take a bath, and doing really a lot of stuff that I didn't supposed to have to do.
Maybe that's the way God planned it, that we was there and we didn't go home, but I just couldn't see myself just going home knowing that those people are there.
I'm not gonna lose nothing for staying to help them. I just felt staying to help them because that's just the right thing to do, you know what I mean?
To me, it just felt like regular. It didn't even feel like extra or special or something. I was just doing something that what I felt was right.
I just stay because I have a mom, I have a dad, so why would I leave them? And why would I leave these other people? Because I felt really bad. I got a small little heart, so it hurts every time when I see stuff like this, you know what I mean?
If you happen to come into a situation like the situation that we had, just do the right thing, you know? Treat people the way you want to be treated if. And I think that the world would be a lot easier if everybody treated people the way that they would want to be treated. You know what I mean?
That was Miguel Alvarez and Maurice Roland speaking with one another in a StoryCorps booth. That piece was produced by Bowen Wang. You can find more information on how to record your own story with San Francisco StoryCorps. Go to our website, kalw.org, and click Cross Currents to find out. We're going to end today's show on a note close to home with a story about a San Francisco landmark that serves as KLW's backyard. Ask anyone to name San Francisco's largest park and you'll likely get the right answer, Golden Gate Park. But if you ask for the name of the park ranked close behind, you'll probably get some wild guesses or blank stares. How is it that McLaren Park is so little known? And why is it named McLaren? KLW's Stephen Short shares the answer to these questions in this episode of The Source.
Don't take this the wrong way, Golden Gate Park, but Phil Ginsberg...
I'm the general manager of San Francisco's Recreation and Park Department.
Phil Ginsberg sounds as if he might like another city park better.
You know, Golden Gate Park gets the attention, but McLaren Park is really an incredible jewel, and it's not just a neighborhood park. I think of it as more of a regional asset.
Like a good parent, Ginsberg tries not to have favorites. Still,
very few cities in America are blessed to have a park like McLaren Park within its boundaries because of its topography and not just its size.
That size, by the way, at just over 300 acres, is a little less than one-third of the size of Golden Gate Park.
It's hilly, it's natural, it has some incredible recreation. It's really got a little bit of everything for everyone.
So, fittingly, it's named for San Francisco's long-serving superintendent of parks, John McLaren. But if it's so great, then why isn't it better known? You know what they say about real estate. It's all about location.
Particularly at a time before our mass transit system, has become as robust as it is, and, you know, maybe even going back historically, a time before there were that many cars in San Francisco, it was far.
And tucked down in the southeast corner of the city, it's still far, unless you happen to live nearby, even with our robust mass transit system. But did he say going back historically? Well, let's just do that.
McLaren Park was actually originally the home to the Ohlone Indians.
And if you'd been around then, you would have seen why. This is not the part of the San Francisco Peninsula to the northwest, which was made up of sand dunes.
You would have seen incredible habitat. You would have seen a big variety of plants and mushrooms and insects and animals. It was the wild.
Wild habitat is great for mushrooms and insects, but few people wanted to build houses there. So after several land deals, the city decreed in 1928 that this area should be a public park. And they had just the right man to transform it into what Ginsberg calls an incredible jewel.
John McLaren was a Scottish gardener and was really responsible with William Hammond Hall for the creation of Golden Gate Park first, and then ultimately our entire park system. And he was our first superintendent. He actually was a superintendent for over 50 years.
Over 50 years?
And actually, our city forefathers gave him a lifetime appointment to be superintendent.
They also doubled his salary when he was 70, and he lived in what is now the park headquarters until his death. That building in Golden Gate Park is now known as McLaren Lodge.
And he actually continued to serve until his death when he was 96. And his body laid in state in the City Hall Rotunda. I doubt very few bureaucrats today, including me, would get that honor.
One reason he may have served so long was because people actually feared him. Published reports say his gardeners gave a coded warning when McLaren was spotted coming their way.
Hey, Joe, there's wild game coming.
Yeah, he was known to be a very tough disciplinarian. He was, frankly, known to be a pretty cantankerous and cranky guy who loved park stewardship.
Ginsberg says it's thanks to McLaren's stubbornness and determination that we even have Golden Gate Park today. William Hammond Hall designed it, but it was McLaren who was really responsible
for taking what is nothing but beach, or was nothing but beach, and converting it into this just oasis of open space and flora and fauna that we have today.
All of this devotion to urban open space would be reason enough to honor this man by naming a park for him. But consider this.
John McLaren was actually credited with planting over 2 million trees, which is pretty remarkable in and of itself.
A statue of McLaren was made during his lifetime, but he wouldn't allow it to be installed. It wasn't necessarily due to modesty. Ginsberg says he just hated statues in parks.
He also hated keep off the grass signs. He felt nobody should be told to stay off the grass.
But he wasn't a mean old taskmaster to everybody.
He was known for standing outside McLaren Lodge on Sundays, and he would give out candy to kids as they came into the park. So although he was known to be a rather gruff fellow, it is clear that he had a very soft heart.
Providing the kids put any wrappers in the trash cans. John McLaren's influence over Golden Gate Park and the other 219 parks in the San Francisco system is still felt by those in charge today. Sometimes, Ginsberg says, that influence is almost physically tangible.
We have a big portrait of him that sits in the commission room here at McLaren Lodge. And while we are all there and he's having staff meetings and he's looking over us, I think we all still feel a certain sense of awe to be in his presence. And he's basically looking down at us saying, don't screw up my park.
Well, now here's the question. First you said he was looking over you, then you said he was looking down on you. Which is he doing?
He's definitely looking down at us. There's no question about it.
In San Francisco, I'm Stephen Short for Cross Currents.
Find more stories from The Source at our website, klw.org. Click Cross Currents.
That's it for today's show. Our team includes Asal Ehsanipour, Nina Gensler-Debs, Raquel Maria Dillon, Lisa Morehouse, Zaina Nasser, Andrew Stelzer, and Josh Wilson. Our engineers are Gabe Graben and Jackie Sujiko. Our line producer is Hannah Kingsley Ma. Jen Sheehan is our managing editor. Our news director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is from the Afro-Cuban Jazz Cartel. They are playing Cigar Bar in San Francisco this Friday. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.